We are talking today with Steve Hendricks. Steve Hendricks is a freelance investigative reporter who has written for numerous publications, including the San Francisco Chronicle, The Nation, The Denver Post, The Boston Globe, Double Take, Counterpunch, and The Seattle Weekly. And he is here to talk about his new book, The Unquiet Grave, The FBI and the Struggle for the Soul of Indian Country. Steve, thank you very much for spending time with us today.
It's a great pleasure to be back in Seattle. Thanks, Mike.
If you would begin and tell us, what was the motivation in writing your book, The Unquiet Grave?
It wasn't the book that I set out to write. My wife and I had recently moved to Montana, and I wanted to write a story about a pressing social justice issue in our backyard. So I focused in on Indian reservations. I knew I was going to write a book about Indians. But what I had set out to do was to write a book that explained why one particular reservation in eastern Montana was still so very poor, despite so many efforts that had been tried over the years. I wanted to know why they had all failed dismally. And when I went out to read about it, I didn't find the answers. So as I set about researching this, it turned out that this was a very amorphous subject. It ended up kind of being potentially a sprawling economic history, which was a little daunting and, to be frank, undramatic, and very important, but hard to build a story around. But as I was looking into this, one of the things that I came upon, one of the reasons that these people were having such a hard time was their rights movement, the major Indian rights movement of the 1970s, had been crushed. And I kept hearing stories about how this movement had been crushed and various atrocities or alleged atrocities that had been committed back in the 70s, most of them centered out in South Dakota, but throughout the country in several reservations. And the more I dug into it, the more I thought, boy, there's a meaty story. The last major book that had been written about it was Peter Matheson's In the Spirit of Crazy Horse in 1983, a magisterial, enormous book. And I wanted to know, this was in 2003 when I was looking at it, what had happened in the 20 years since then and what had been learned, because it was such a, there's so many revelations and so many questions that were raised in Matheson's book, and I wanted to know what more had come out. And the short answer was not very much at all. So I took on this book as a way, I hoped, of filling part of that void.
All right. And the centerpiece of the book starts focusing with one person. Can you tell us who that is?
Yes, that's Anna Mae Aquash. She was a Mi'kmaq Indian from Canada, from Nova Scotia, who became involved in the American Indian movement when she migrated to the United States in the early 70s. She migrated a little before that, but she was abnormal in the sense that in the American Indian movement, as in so many of these progressive leftist movements of the 60s, 70s, 50s, it was the men who tended to rise to the public top and get all the glory. And while the men certainly did their fair share of the work, or a lot of it, it was the women who did an enormous amount of work behind the scenes and got very little credit. She was a very charismatic person who wouldn't stand in the background and yet at the same time wasn't overly forceful and threatening to her sort of male leader. She walked a fine political line, and she rose to the top of AIM. In doing so, she became a target of the FBI. Rumors were spread about her, that she was an informer, and these rumors grew and grew and grew. And eventually, to cut to the chase, she was murdered. And the mystery at the heart of my book, as you said, I start with her story and her murder, and the mystery is who killed her. The intrigue around her murder is one of the greatest causes and recurring anguish themes in Indian country today. What had happened was, in the spring of 1976, February, so late winter of 1976, out on the edge of the Badlands on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, which was the epicenter of the conflict between the FBI and the American Indian movement, a body was found, a Jane Doe, to hear the FBI tell the story, there was no sign whatsoever that this woman had died of anything other than exposure. She was found completely out in the middle of nowhere, and they essentially argue that she had wandered out from a bar or something drunk and just died out there, 20 miles from the nearest possible bar, but that was their argument. They say they took her in to the capital of the reservation, Pine Ridge Town, and had an autopsy done. At the autopsy, they saw nothing of any suspicion. They could not identify her. They concluded, incidentally, that she had died of exposure. The government's coroner did. They could not identify her, they claimed, although she was a highly wanted fugitive, very sought after by the FBI, one of the few women Indian fugitives anywhere in the country, let alone in that part of the country where the hunt was focused for her. Couldn't identify her, they claimed, and so rather than take her fingerprints at the site of the autopsy at the hospital, they chopped off her hands and sent them to Washington, D.C., a gruesome procedure that is only very, very rarely used, and in this case completely unnecessary because her fingers could have been printed at the site. While the FBI lab in D.C. was trying to identify her, the FBI and Bureau of Indian Affairs, which shared criminal responsibility jurisdiction over crimes on Indian reservations with the FBI, the FBI and BIA said, her body is deteriorating even further. She'd lain out in the elements for some time before her death. And we can't keep it, so we've got to bury it. So they rush her into the ground in an unmarked grave before the identification comes back. Problem with that story is the mortician who was holding the body said the body would have been just absolutely fine, would have stayed in his mortuary for another several weeks without any trouble. No sooner is she buried than she is. Word comes back from the FBI lab in D.C. saying this is Anna Mae Aquash, this highly sought-after fugitive. Well, at this point, all hell breaks out in Indian country. Her family does not believe in the least, nor do her friends in the movement, that she had just wandered off somewhere and died on a drunk. She wouldn't have. She was a good backpacker. She was strong, etc. But beyond that, she was heavily hunted by the FBI, and she was, in addition to being hunted by the FBI, she was she had all these rumors swirling around her within the American Indian movement, which at this time was filled with paranoia from the FBI, and there was fear that people in AIM might have done her in as well. The FBI might have wanted to do her in, so the theory went, because she was soon due to testify and would have been a very potent witness, testifying in trials related to the killing of two FBI agents on Pine Ridge the year before by Indian activists in a shootout at Oglala. That was the shootout for which Leonard Peltier, perhaps the most famous Indian activist in the country, Indian martyr, was imprisoned and is still in prison. So the family immediately wanted the body exhumed. They exhumed the body. When they did, they had an independent coroner, a pathologist of their own choosing. And this pathologist, the second he saw the body, noticed what appeared to be a lump in the forehead. And within moments after that, found a very obvious bullet entrance wound in the back at the base of the skull. What he was looking at in the front of the forehead was the bullet lodged in the forehead. So almost impossible to conceive that the coroner for the government who did the first autopsy actually missed it. The thought is that he missed, in quotes, missed it intentionally. And there are, I could continue on, but from this, from the, depending upon how you look at it, botched autopsy or intentionally botched autopsy, from the severing of her hands, which some people speculate, I think justifiably, that was done in order to delay the identification. If you take fingerprints there at the first autopsy on site, you can ship those fingerprints off to D.C., really you fax them essentially, and get an identification right away. What the speculation was that the hands were cut off in order to have to ship the hands those several days to D.C., then to give the people out on Pine Ridge, the FBI and BIA officers and agents there, an excuse to bury the body, get it in the ground, hide the evidence, because the FBI feared that it may have been one of their people who had carried it out. And that is a long answer to your question of who she is. But I start my book with her story because it's obviously, it's a potent story. It's a story that capsulizes this work of the FBI to undermine the American Indian movement and why they are so untrusted out there today. And it also capsulizes this sort of lurking question of, did AIM have something to do with her murder, and sort of more broadly, how did AIM react to the efforts of the FBI and other federal agencies to undermine them?
So, and was that the extent of the investigation at the time?
On the FBI's part?
Yeah, on the federal level.
After she was exhumed and the bullet was found in her head, there then arose depending upon how you look at it, a thorough investigation by the FBI. And it was thorough in the sense that they spent a lot of man hours on it. But one of the very interesting things about it is, and they couldn't solve it. So the case went unsolved for decades until I believe it was 2003, they finally brought indictments against two men, two Indians, for killing her. One by the name of Arla Looking Cloud, who was convicted of murdering Aquash in 2004 in Rapid City, and the other, a fellow named John Graham, who is currently, he's Canadian, and he's awaiting extradition. He's fighting extradition from Vancouver right now. And it's been a rather big story in Vancouver because Leonard Peltier, whom I mentioned earlier, was also extradited from Vancouver and was done so on the basis of fraudulent affidavits that were submitted to the Canadian government by the FBI. So there's great fear among Indians and their allies about whether the FBI and their allies here in the States can be trusted to extradite Graham. So for decades, the FBI claims we can't solve this murder. We can't solve this murder because no one will talk to us. Out in Indian country, we're not trusted because of this period of turmoil back in the 70s. We did all these things, and Indians did these things, but, you know, whoever did what, the upshot of it is there's a long-lasting distrust. So we can't get the informers and other sources to tell us what we need to know. It's a nice claim. However, in my research, one of the big things I was able to do was to pry at least a few documents from the FBI's treasure trove of documents about this time from them. And what I found was that although the FBI claims that they didn't know anything about this, there was an informer's report from Denver saying correctly, this was the sequence of events leading to Aquash's death, there's a woman being held kidnapped, essentially, here in Denver. She was taken just the other day by three people, which is true, from Denver to Rapid City, was interrogated there by other Indians as to whether she was an informer, and then they drove her around out on the reservation before killing her. And the three people are named blank, blank, and blank. Almost certainly, those three names are John Graham, who I just mentioned, Arla Looking Cloud, whom I just mentioned, and Theda Clark, who was an older woman who was also with them and part of the party that had driven her around and eventually killed her. Theda Clark hasn't been charged because supposedly she has Alzheimer's, and the government says she's too old. When I visited her, she seemed perfectly lucid, but that's their claim. So here's this document that shows within days of Aquash's murder, the FBI knew essentially, at a minimum, they knew that it was done, how it was done, probably why it was done, and if those three names match the three names of the people who did it, and they almost certainly do, they even know who did it. And yet the FBI claims that they couldn't solve this for decades. Now, what's going on here? And I should clarify, the FBI gets a lot of leads, right? So you want to cut them a little slack. Maybe they thought this was a red herring. Well, she was killed in December of 75. They didn't pay any attention to this, informers report. After her body was found in February, they went back and looked at it and said, oh yeah, oops, this is definitely Aquash. No doubt about it, this is her. So they knew, and they've got in writing that they knew. And they won't release any other documents that shed more light on how much more they knew and what they did. But the speculation in Indian country for the longest time was that the FBI had an informer, perhaps an operative, an agent provocateur, who was too close to her murder, who maybe was involved in, you know, he wasn't one of the trigger men. We now know that, though that wasn't known at the time, and the FBI may have feared that he was, but at a minimum may have been involved in the discussions within the American Indian movement and other allies of theirs about whether Aquash was an informer, and if so, whether she should be killed. AIM, incidentally, had been, or not so incidentally, had been infiltrated by any number of FBI informers and operatives and agent provocateurs. The most famous of them was a fellow named Doug Durham, who had risen to the very top of AIM. His job was National Director of Security, in which he was supposed to ferret out the informers and operatives that the FBI had sent into the movement. And many of these informers were exposed. And you can imagine the kind of paranoia, which was exactly the point of it. This was the FBI's purpose in doing it. Part of it was getting information. Part of it, stated in their documents, was to seed paranoia among leftist groups. You can imagine the paranoia that broke out when these informers were uncovered and exposed. So they'd let all these informers go, one after another, and by the time of Aquash, they were so paranoid that they decided they probably needed to send a message to the next informer they found, which, you know, would be a lot stronger than letting her go. And as it happened, probably turned out to be having her killed. It's not something that I condone in the least, but I do think it is very important for historical reasons and for activists who are trying to learn from past mistakes to understand both that AIM probably did it in one level or another, and that they were goaded into doing it by the federal government. So there's this speculation, to get back to the other side of the circle where I was going, that there was an informer who was too close to Aquash's murder. This was not something that I could solve conclusively in my book, whether that was in fact the case. But I was able to find one particular person who was almost certainly involved in the discussions within the American Indian movement about whether Aquash should be killed, including some of the very final discussions, it seems, may have been part of the decision, the final decision. Yes, we need to kill her, let's put a bullet in her brain, but it's not clear. But at any rate, was fairly close to some of this, who, at a minimum, I was able to find and prove to my satisfaction, wanted to be an informer of the American Indian movement. And this was a fella who was very close to all the principals who were either involved in or whom the FBI wanted to find for questioning about the shootout at Oglala on the Pine Ridge Reservation in 1975 that I'd mentioned earlier, in which two FBI agents and one Indian were killed. This very famous shootout that was at the heart of Robert Redford's movie called Incident at Oglala, the heart of Peter Matheson's book In the Spirit of Crazy Horse, and so on. So it's very hard to imagine that this fella, his name is David Hill, goes to the FBI, as he did, so I am told very reliably, and said, hey, you know, I know Leonard Peltier, I know Dennis Banks, I know all these guys who you're looking for, and I want to be an informer. And the FBI's got every possible agent in the country involved on this case, and they say, oh, no thanks, we don't want you. So what probably happened was, Hill says, I want to be an informer. The FBI says, sure. He may have been important to them. He may not have been. The FBI agent who was ultimately over him, or would have been over him, assuming that Hill was an informer, said that Hill gave him nothing. Hill had no information for him of value. May be true, may not be true. I couldn't figure that out. But what is almost certain was that he was there. He was involved at some level in these discussions about Aquash, and probably, though not certainly, that's why the FBI didn't want to solve this case for so many decades.
So clearly the FBI was the agency in charge of this particular situation, as well as the overall program against AIM. Were there other U.S. government agencies involved in this, and did they just follow the FBI's lead?
It's a good question. My book is subtitled The FBI and the Struggle for the Soul of Indian Country, in part because it is the FBI was the lead agency, but in part because you can't subtitle a book. The FBI, the BIA, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the U.S. Marshals Service, the Justice Department, various state governments and tribal governments, and the struggle for the soul of Indian Country. You know, the person in me who writes all these endnotes in the book that my publisher would probably assume I cut really would like a subtitle like that, because it was a concerted and sustained government-wide effort. And by government-wide, I mean both the federal government and, particularly in South Dakota, the state government, which was extremely racist against Indians. And there were a whole host of agencies. If the FBI had been just the problem, let's say, for example, on Pine Ridge Reservation, which we've been talking about. On Pine Ridge, there was a strong-armed tribal president named Dick Wilson, and he had set up a goon squad. His enemies called him the goon squad because they went around and beat up people. The goons themselves took the epithet as a name of pride and said it was an acronym that stood for Guardians of the Oglala Nation, the Oglala Lakotas being the Indians of that reservation. So the goons would go around, they would beat up people, they would shoot at people, they might have killed people, they would threaten people, and the FBI wouldn't investigate. Now that's a big problem, because it's hard to prosecute without the investigation. But a prosecutor, a federal prosecutor who was interested in pursuing the case, might have been able to bring some anyway, if they had wanted. But, as it happened, the U.S. Attorney's Office, which is a subunit of the Justice Department, just as the FBI is, was of the exact same mind as the FBI about the American Indian Movement, and would refuse to prosecute. If, by some miracle, and there were a couple of cases like this, where the FBI refused to investigate, U.S. Attorney's Office refused to prosecute, and the American Indian Movement raised such an enormous fuss in the press that they forced from Washington, D.C., forced superiors in D.C. to say, you know, we're getting a lot of bad press about this. You really ought to prosecute this particular murder of this particular aimer by the goon squad. There were a case or two where that happened. You then went before a federal judge. There was only one who was in charge of Western South Dakota, and was the judge of first resort for criminal cases on the reservation, who was as racist as any federal or state judge in Mississippi in 1930 towards blacks. If you somehow could get a case brought in state court, you couldn't for crimes on the reservation, but there were also atrocities committed against AIM and their allies off the reservations. If you went to state court, you faced the exact same thing at all levels of the government. So it was you have to be a little careful in phrasing this, because it was a policy that was across the federal and state governments to squash this movement. Now, when you say that, people assume it was sort of monolithic, all-powerful, even all-pervasive, and it wasn't. These agencies were a mix of, you know, if you spend any time looking into the FBI, you find that they're a mix of people who are some folks who are extremely competent, and they've got that Big Brother is looking over your shoulder no matter where you go. And other times it's Keystone Cops. And that was true of all of these agencies. So it was more than just the FBI. But there were holes and gaps and, you know, it wasn't like there was one memo that was written from the White House that said, okay, everyone get on board and we're all going to do this. It was more that they all thought along the same lines and complemented each other's efforts.
Give us a sense for how AIM was perceived by both the media and citizens at the time. Were they like the equivalent of what a terrorist organization would be now?
Well, it's interesting that you ask that, because they did do their most famous act in many ways was the seizure of the village of Wounded Knee in 1973, which now would certainly be branded a terrorist act. What had happened was the village of Wounded Knee sits on Pine Ridge Reservation. Pine Ridge Reservation was one of these places that we've been talking about where every legal avenue of change was blocked by all levels of governments. So after, you know, trying to go to the courts, after trying to impeach the president and having that sort of illegally squashed too, after trying to change things legislatively within the tribal council, and all of these things getting slammed down in sort of the in about the way that you would expect if, say, a black group tried to do something in Alabama or deep Georgia in 1942 or something. Like, it's just, you know, there was absolutely no legal remedy. But instead of choosing civil disobedience, as Martin Luther King and company did, what they did was they decided they were going to seize the village of Wounded Knee with arms. Wounded Knee, of course, the site of the historic massacre in the 1890s, by the 7th Cavalry, which was Custer's reconstituted cavalry after it had been destroyed at Little Bighorn. They were of a vengeful mind, and they killed, depending upon which side you listen to, between 150 and 300 Indians, gunned them down, slaughtered them. So to take this village had enormous resonance with people, and it was a wise, savvy move by AIM to choose this village. But they took it with guns. They held hostages for the first couple of days of the siege. Eventually, they let the hostages go, and eventually, the hostages decided to stay because they were believed in the cause in part, and partly because their property was there, and they were afraid that if they weren't there, then the federal troops would move in and destroy everything. But so AIM seizes this village. They're surrounded by a makeshift army of hundreds of FBI officers, U.S. Marshals, BIA police officers, and at first hundreds and then eventually thousands of bullets are flying back and forth each day, most of them coming from the government side. When this happened, a curious thing took place in the country. Polls were taken. What do you think of this seizure of an American town by a group of rebels? More than 50% of the American public said, overdue, good thing, should have happened sooner, we support it. Now, isn't that just stunning? I mean, we're talking about what happened in Chiapas, you know, just a few years ago in Mexico. It wasn't quite as broad and widespread and organized as that, but that's what we're talking about. This was a true rebellion, and more than half the country supported it. It was an amazing thing and a testament to AIM's savvy. They held that village for 71 days against this cordon of troops that were around them. They did so because people kept sneaking through the ravines and valleys at night to resupply them, and they did that because AIM was very sharp with the media. They were able to wed this solemn place and all these grievances with a very feisty theater-like kind of thing. For example, one of the things they did when they seized Wounded Knee, the first thing was to declare themselves a new nation. They were the independent Oglala Nation, and they issued passports to all of their citizenry, all the people who had come in to help seize it with them, and they radioed out to the federal troops across the siege lines, lay down your weapons, come on over across the international frontier, and you will be treated in accordance with the Geneva Conventions, which, I might add, is more than one can say for our government today. So this kind of bravado that they were able to do drew an enormous following. It didn't last. And herein is, again, as I mentioned before, a lesson for activists. Because what happened was the media got to know AIM, and they were pulled to them at first, and the headlines were great, and the news clips on the broadcast, the TV and radio were just gripping and compelling. As they got deeper into the story and got to know these guys, most of them were guys who led AIM, they found that it wasn't pretty. These were folks who had been in prison, nearly every single one of them, and when they were punched in the face, what they did was to punch back. These were, again, to go back to the analogy to the black civil rights movement, these were the Black Panthers. These weren't the Martin Luther Kings. And there were understandable reasons for a lot of that. I mean, to a person, almost every one of these leaders of AIM had been ripped from their homes by the federal government at the age of 4 or 5, taken from their families by force, shipped off into boarding schools where they were stripped of their language, of their culture, of their religion. These were schools that were run by abusive people. Often they were Catholic or Catholic-influenced schools. They were on severe regimens. They were beaten. And the way you survive in a place like that is, you know, you're essentially a saint if you make it through there alive, or you turn out to be a criminal. And most of these guys went the criminal route. They then, you know, got out and went about their way for a few years, and all of them ended up in prison. AIM liked to say that their movement was born in the Iron House, the Indians' word for a prison, and it's true. They got to prison and they started looking around and saying, "What the hell are all these Indians doing here? Why are we all in here?" And thinking about the reasons for that and what they could do about it. And again, I'm a nonviolent follower myself. I don't believe in taking up arms unless you have to, in part just for very practical reasons. It's very hard to win against the U.S. government if you pick up arms. You gain a lot more, I think, if you go nonviolent. But they disagreed. And as the media began to get a sense of, you know, these guys really did believe in picking up arms and shooting people if they needed to, and it lost them a lot of support. And as they became more and more hunted and infiltrated by the FBI, and as they reacted to that more and more violently, often quite justifiably, juries found when they would be taken to trial for some of these. For example, in the killings of the two FBI agents at Pine Ridge, Leonard Peltier was convicted, but there was another trial of two other Indians, Dino Butler and Bob Robideau, and the jury essentially found that even if they were there and had pulled the triggers on those FBI agents, that they were justified in doing so because of the paranoia that the FBI was seeding inside AIM and the refusal to prosecute that the U.S. Attorney's Office was doing and so on. They had created this atmosphere where AIM felt that they had absolutely no choice but to shoot back in self-defense. But so even if you buy that argument, it's still a very hard case to lay out in 30-second sound bites in front of the American public. You may get it in front of a jury. It's a hard case to make in front of the public, and they eventually lost first their support in trickles and then their support in floods. And that is in large part why the movement collapsed.
We're talking with Steve Hendricks, author of the new book, The Unquiet Grave, The FBI and the Struggle for the Soul of Indian Country. So your research in this involved both official FBI documents as well as interviews, is that right?
Correct.
And you're dealing with something that basically happened 30 years ago. Can you tell us about the challenges of both getting the documents as well as doing these interviews with people?
Sure. Let me start with the documents. The book is based more on documents than anything else. And in part, that's because I wrote this book on a shoestring, and it takes an enormous amount of money to go out and do investigative work when you're trying to interview people all over the country. It's very hard to show up on someone's doorstep on Pine Ridge Reservation, particularly if you're a white guy like me, and say, "Hi, Mr. Ms. Indian friend, can you tell me about this murder that you witnessed 30 years ago and haven't talked about because you're afraid of losing your life?" So I did do those interviews and all, but with limited budget, I focused where I could. And the one ace in my hole is I happened to be married to a lawyer who had a practice that involved suing government agencies, among other things that she did, for freedom of information requests. She had never done a federal case before. We were living in Montana, and she had done state cases and thought she would like to try a federal case. much to her regret. It's now almost about 3.5 years later, and we are still suing. Our suits are ongoing for these documents. But to get back to the documents, what happens is the Freedom of Information Act, procedurally it's very complicated, but what it essentially says is very simple. It can be boiled down to this. If you're asking for documents that do not violate national security type interests, and they don't violate the privacy of a living person, government has to hand them over to you in 20 days. Some dire emergency, I think they can take up to 30 days. Even if it violates the privacy interests of a living person, if there is a compelling public interest in them, government has to hand them over. So a typical case for me would be I would request, say, documents about a leader of the traditional faction, the AIM faction, on Pine Ridge Reservation by the name of Pedro Bissonnette. Bissonnette was shot and killed by BIA police in October 1973. You say, the American Indian Movement would say that he was assassinated by the BIA police for his political views. The BIA police say, no, we shot him in justifiable self-defense when he stepped out of his car and waved a rifle at us. Pretty, you know, compelling public interest there. In addition to that, he's dead, so there's no living person. The victim has no privacy interest to protect. The two cops who shot him were public officers performing public duties. They don't have any privacy interest to protect. It's 30 years old, and God knows, even if it were yesterday that it happened, there's no national security interest to worry about here. So I'm expecting I'm going to get these documents in 20, 30 days, right, after I make my FOIA request. Well, what happens is I send off the request, 20 days pass, 20 days pass, another 20 days pass. Eventually, the FBI says, we will get you some documents, probably, but it'll be about 2 years before we process them. I have seen some cases where the FBI asked, despite the plain language of the Freedom of Information Act saying 20 days, for 7 years before they even processed the documents. And by processing means, let's say in Bissonnette's case, they've got a 1,000-page file on him and his killing. They may go through that, that's their processing, and figure out that you only get 100 pages of that. So after the 2 years elapse, they give you the 100 pages, and I can guarantee you that of those 100 pages, the best stuff is all heavily censored, blacked out. So then you got to fight over that. So we sued. The only recourse you have if you want to get this in time is to sue. And the FBI knows that FOIA is a procedurally complicated law and that you can't just go down to your lawyer who writes wills and say, will you bring me a FOIA suit? You've got to have a specialized lawyer and it costs money. And that's one of the hurdles. And they're very well aware of this. And I should say that the true victim of this having to sue is not me. It's not the reporter out there who can't get the files to write his story, although I think if it were just me, that would be cause enough, as I see myself anyway as a representative of the public. But it's particularly the poor folks, like Indians, who have a long history of discrimination and abuse and neglect, and so have very few lawyers, very few spare money to go around. What lawyers and money and time and expertise they have, believe me, they got other problems to focus on right now than what happened to them 30 years ago. So they don't get this part of their history. It's hidden from them. And it's one of the reasons why, as I said at the start of this interview, I think one of the very big reasons why there haven't been any major books about this since Peter Matheson's In the Spirit of Crazy Horse in 1973. So anyway, we sue, and you go before a judge, and you get to, you know, before the judge, ask the FBI, so why aren't you getting this stuff to us in a reasonable amount of time? FOIA says 20 days, you say 2 years, you know. You're an agency that knows a little bit of something about laws. Can't you figure out that you're breaking the law here, et cetera, et cetera? And their typical answer is, well, we've got a big backlog. It's a completely irrelevant argument. FOIA doesn't allow you to, like, be late just because you have a backlog. But the fascinating thing is judges buy it. They defer to the FBI. Most judges live in awe of the FBI. A lot of them were former prosecutors themselves. And they don't enforce FOIA. So we had, according to my in-house counsel, we had a good judge for one of our suits who said, FOIA says 20 days, Steve, you're right that they should have handed it over those to you forever ago. It's now been 6 or 8 months. But, you know, it's just really unrealistic to think that they're going to hand them over tomorrow. So why don't we give them another 6, 8 months? You sue anyway because getting the stuff in, say, 16, 18 months, whatever, is a lot better than getting it in 3 years. And there's no point in appealing because your appeal of that judge's decision, A, probably would get slapped down because judges all the way up are not enforcing FOIA, but B, because your appeal would take that long anyway. So there's the matter of the timing. And then the other thing that you argue before the judge is what actually is released, how much they can withhold, how much they can censor, and things like that. It gets complicated, and I'm already going long-winded here, so I won't go too much into that, but I will tell you my favorite part of it. The most common reason that we got over and over and over why the FBI won't release this 30-year-old stuff that is violating no one's privacy rights or so on is, in their argument, they say, most of the stuff that you are requesting comes from informers. And to give you this information would either violate, or both, violate the privacy interest of those informers, or would violate the privacy interests of the people they spied upon. Now, bear in mind, they weren't spying on mob kingpins. They weren't spying on Al-Qaeda. They were spying on, for the most part, very peaceful political dissidents. There were the leaders in AIM who had taken over Wounded Knee through force of arms, but most of AIM was extremely peaceful, nonviolent, and they were spying on people all over the country who had never picked up a gun in their lives. And their argument was, it's this beautiful catch-22. We violated these people's privacy illegally 30 years ago, and now we can't tell you how we violated their privacy because to do so would further violate their privacy. They take this argument to judges, and once again, more often than not, judges buy it because we can't prove, because we haven't seen another catch-22, we can't prove, because we haven't seen what they've withheld, that what they're withholding was in fact illegally collected information, and because we can't prove by, proves not the word, but judges aren't swayed by the fact that the FBI had a long, very well-documented history of undermining not just AIM, but all kinds of leftist groups. In other words, we go and we say, hey, judge, this was an FBI that when Martin Luther King, when it was announced he was to be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, sent him a blackmail letter trying to get him to kill himself before he was awarded the prize. It's in writing. This was an FBI that only a few years before, when Black Panthers and other black nationalists were shooting and killing each other in the ghetto of San Diego, the field officers in San Diego wrote memos to J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI in D.C., saying, we can only hope that it was our work of seeding and sowing misinformation and distrust that led to these killings. I mean, there's just no doubt whatsoever that the FBI was undermining all these groups. You go to a judge, and the judge says, well, you know, they may have been doing that to the Panthers, to King, to the Communist Party, to the Socialists, to on and on and on and on and on. But you can't say with 100% certainty that that's what they were doing to AIM. So we're not going to make them give you this stuff, or at any rate, very little. It's a heck of an argument to have to try to overcome, and very rarely do you overcome it. But occasionally, I guess the final part I should add, a few nuggets drop out. You sue anyway, and you fight, and you scratch, and you claw, and a few nuggets drop out. It was those, more than anything else, that allowed me to write this book.
And you still trying to extract stuff from the FBI?
Exactly. Yes, we've got ongoing cases, and the biggest one is probably about this informer I had mentioned earlier, this man named Doug Durham, who had risen to the post of head of national security for AIM, ferreting out informers. That's the biggest one I've got ongoing now. We want his files. And he's got a 2,000-page file or something like that, and the FBI is only giving me 200 pages. So with any luck, I'll be back here talking to you in 4 years, and maybe I'll have those, or a few nuggets from them, at least.
So this is kind of turning into a lifetime work in progress.
Much to my wife's regret, yes.
So how did this particular project, your book, compare with other investigative work that you've done in the past in terms of scope?
Far more than anything I had ever done before. Most of the writings that I had done in the past were wild journalism, not necessarily investigative in nature. You mentioned I'd written for The Weekly here in Seattle back when I lived here in the early 90s. And most of my articles were about transit. We were fighting over the rail system back then and whether to build that. It was also urban development. Your studio right here, right across from Denny Park, would have been the heart of the Seattle Commons that was being fought over back then. And those were the sorts of things that I wrote about. They weren't exposés. They weren't investigation. And I had done maybe one piece in my entire career that counted as investigative journalism, in the sense of you're really going and digging up things that people just absolutely don't want to talk about and don't want you to know. Buried secrets, hidden treasures, those kinds of things. Less than sort of commentary on public policy and reporting about events that come to you. So I learned as I went. I took this on not really knowing how to do it. I botched some things. If I'd had to do it all over, I'd probably get much more information than I'd have gotten. But the surprising thing is that it's all about persistence. And if you're able to do that and not get too discouraged and, you know, can write a few words, you too can be an investigative reporter. And that's what it boiled down to.
Did you encounter a lot of things that deeply surprised you or shocked you?
There were many things. Do you mean sort of revelations in the book or how the reporting went along the way?
Actually, both.
I'll tell you. I'll start with the stuff along the way. One of the things that did surprise me was my career is in politics. I had dabbled for years between writing about political stuff and doing political stuff. I came to Seattle in 92 to work on Patty Murray's first political campaign, and sort of for the next 10 years here and in Montana, where I moved to, had been doing both. So I'm someone who, you know, is spending my day among activists and so on, and it's not, or I used to be, and it's not a completely self-contained world. You know, our job as activists was to go out and convince people who weren't. But it was stunning to me the level of apathy that I found when I went out to report this story. Part of it was apathy and part of it was ignorance. By that I mean a few things. First of all, I sort of assumed that most people would not want to talk about these old cases. But I kind of figured I would stumble on someone every now and again in Indian country who said, I've been waiting 30 years to tell this story to someone. Thank God, you know, someone's finally coming out and asking. I almost never found that. It was like pulling teeth to get this story out of people. And part of that was the difficulty of a white guy going on to an Indian reservation where there's been a lot of white against Indian racism for many years and trying to get this story cold without having had a lot of contacts out there. So that was one surprise. Another surprise was how little the story was known, even within Indian country. We've been talking about the Pine Ridge Reservation, where most of this stuff took place. You go out there, you ask teenagers in high school what they know about this stuff, what they've learned of it. Almost nothing. Many of them, you know, they might know the name American Indian Movement, but beyond that, they know very little. So that was a disheartening surprise as well. And then a final one that I'll tell you about, surprise that I encountered, was how hard it was to get editors on the coasts to care about this story. You know, as you know, it is wonderful to be on programs such as yours that care about these issues. But the big gateways for these information are in New York and in Los Angeles, San Francisco and Chicago and so on. And all of us who aren't in those epicenters like struggle sometimes to get our issues out in either middle America or the far Northwest here noticed. And time and again, I would go to editors. You know, as I was writing the story, as I was writing the book, I had little breakable pieces that could be broken off and become magazine or newspaper articles, and I would try to sell those to the New York Timeses of the world and so on, and the New Yorkers, and all the way on down the food chain to the, you know, little quarterlies in western North Carolina or something. And time and again, when I brought them a story related to this, they would say something along the lines of, you know, fascinating, you know, very interesting stuff. We'll talk to the other editors, and they'd come back and say, thanks, we don't want it. And eventually I would ask them, you know, well, why not? You know, some of this is pretty lurid information. You know, I'm guessing, for example, that if you had some of the documents that I had talked about earlier about the Aquash case, saying that the FBI had essentially covered up what had known about the murder of a black activist in the civil rights era of the 50s or 60s, you'd be all over it. I mean, you're all over the revitalized case of the lynching of Emmett Till and the bombing of the black church in Birmingham where little girls were killed. You know, these people who have done the crimes are now being prosecuted all these years later, and you're covering these stories on your front pages, no less. And what they would say is, you know, they wouldn't put it quite in these words, but my interpretation was, you know, our readers, and for that matter, we ourselves, we don't know a Micmac from a Muskogee, and we don't care. The "we don't care" wasn't something they usually said quite so bluntly, but that was the case. And in order to get people to care about something in an 800-word newspaper article or 500-word article, you have to explain to them why this is important. You know, you've got your revelation here, and you've got to talk about it, but you also have to tell them why they need to know about this and why this matters. And the amount of education that we would have to do to get them up to speed is just more than we can allot ink to. And this happened, you know, I'm picking on the New York Times and so on, but I sold a couple of articles along the way about stuff that's in my book to The Nation magazine, perhaps our most prominent progressive leftist magazine in the country. They professed to like the stories, that they bought them, so obviously they did like them, said they were going to run them, and they killed both of them. One of them, for a fact, was killed. It was put out about the time the stuff, the war in Iraq, was just starting to get launched and heated up, and they bumped it because of pressing events going on. And another, they may have bumped in part because of, for the same reason, there were other pressing events, but also because it was a very controversial piece. It was a piece in which I accused the FBI of giving this prominent politician in South Dakota, Bill Janklow, long-term governor out there, eventually congressman. Folks across the country have probably heard of him because of his manslaughter case where he sped through a stop sign recklessly and killed a motorcyclist a couple years ago and got jailed. Slap on the wrist, really, just barely jailed for that. I was coming to them with this case about how the FBI had given Janklow a pass on an alleged rape that he had committed against an Indian girl years ago. He then rises to become, you know, the most prominent Indian fighter in the country. Among Indians, his name is just synonymous with fighting them. So I would come to them with this story, and the Nation eventually bought it. And I think they killed it in part, as I was saying, because of press of events, but also in part because they thought it was so controversial. And it's not that the Nation is afraid of being sued in general, but the word that I got, sort of quietly, was, we don't want to get sued over something so insignificant. If we're going to get sued, we're going to get sued over going after George Bush on torture or something, you know? It's like, this is a story that no one has ever heard about. If we don't print it, no one's ever going to hear about it until your book comes out. So why should we stick our necks out for this? And when you hear this from your leftist friends, you know, it's very disheartening. And it's part of the reason why I wrote the book was because a book is a bigger thing. A book gets you more interviews and so on. A book is something that people will have to at least pay a little bit of attention to. And my hope is that it will eventually crack some of that resistance that editors have. And I put a little plea in the back of the book that I hope that editors and producers and so on will read my book as a cry from Indian country for help. And just as one final aside, at the time that editors were turning me down on that Bill Janklow story, two interesting things. One was what one editor finally said to me was, this was before his wreck, said, well, you know, the thing is, he's just a pissant congressman from a flyover state. He was a first-term congressman. He may be the longest reigning governor out there and the George Wallace of Indian country, but for us, he's here in D.C. now as a congressman, he's nothing. Why don't you come back to us if he becomes more important? Well, he runs over Randy Scott on his motorcycle, kills him, and all of a sudden he's on the front page all across the country. So I come back to these editors, say, well, he's more prominent now. Is this maybe something you want to cover? And their excuse then was, no, he's going to lose his seat because of this, and we feel it would just be piling on. It's not necessary to do this. And I said, but this is an important part of Indian history. Don't you get the FBI giving him a pass on this alleged rape of this Indian girl? Feeds into this whole thing about the FBI not caring at all about crime on these reservations, particularly if it was white on Indian crime. And there was all this stuff going on with the American Indian movement, and he was an ally of the FBI in their fight against that movement. And anyway, blah, 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 blah. And they said, no, it's just, you know, ancient history. We don't care. Well, a few months later, story comes out that Strom Thurmond has fathered a child from many, 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 many years ago from statutory rape, essentially, of his in-house maid, again, on the front pages all across the country. And what it is we know about the Black Civil Rights Movement, and it's something that instantly editors and producers and the reading public grasps the importance of. Indian country, it's something you have to educate people about.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. In addition to your book, The Unquiet Grave, are there other resources people can turn to? Is there like a website?
You bet. Thanks for asking, Mike. Yes, I do have a website, and it's stevehendricks.org. Hendricks is spelled with a CKS on the end, and there are lots of information there. Much to my publisher's annoyance, I have about 100 pages of endnotes on this book. But that was only about a third of what I originally wrote, and the full endnotes for those who are super interested, researchers and so on, will be posted to my website, as well as other updates and things like that. There are also, you know, various video clips and things like that of me at the website talking a bit about the importance of the book.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
It's been great getting such intelligent questions and being able to answer in a longer format, Mike. I appreciate it.
We've just been talking with Steve Hendricks, author of the new book, The Unquiet Grave, The FBI and the Struggle for the Soul of Indian Country. And again, you can find out more from his website, stevehendricks.org.